This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on our podcast, a step ahead in the race for a COVID vaccine, Moderna's CEO offers an update on safety and trial protocol.
We care deeply that this vaccine is trusted by the public, by clinicians and nurses around the country, so it is used. It would be, of course, a big waste if we work so hard and people don't trust the safety.
A blizzard in September, Wall Street's biggest software IPO ever from a still unprofitable company few had heard of until this week, seasoned tech watcher Doug Clinton.
I think you could see the necessity for software solutions like Snowflake increased by 10x over the next 10 years.
And an investor who got in on the ground floor, Wing VC's Peter Wagner.
This is really one of the fundamental trends of our generation.
Those stories plus a healthy clash of minds and crony capitalism.
They like to mess with me in the control room, Sorkin. I don't want to get you started on this.
If you're trying to bait me, you know my view.
It's Thursday, September 17th, 2020. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Good morning. Welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin, along with Joe Kernan. And they brought Kelly Evans in to take to, you know, to make sure that we behave, Joe.
Andrew, all the way into the studio.
Becky's
all the way into the studio.
You came, you're in the studio.
We're both in the studio.
She's in the studio.
You're on delay.
Yeah, he's on delay. This is going to be fun, Kelly.
I'm in the studio. This is my studio.
It is.
This is the way.
That's fine. You want to stay? You don't want to come back to work like us? That's fine. Just know you have a delay. Let's milk this, Kelly. We can just go back and forth. We don't need to. I mean, we can finish each other's sentences. He's going to be like, he's like 5 seconds behind. This is going to be awesome. Let's really do it.
This is the first time you're back at the NASDAQ in a little while?
No. I go away, and then I'm quarantined. So I went away once in July, came back, was quarantined. But then I finally got back here. Then I went away again and then came back, and I've been quarantined for another 2 weeks.
You got to stop going away. What are you doing?
I guess I wish these states would drop off the list. There's still, I think, there's 57 states on the list. No, that was a different. There's a lot of states on this list. Let's get the, you know, and not all states. I was in a county like where there's an island. I was like, no one was there. And because it's that state, so none of it makes any sense. Anyway, I'm glad to be back. And I hate the delay. And I'm looking at Times Square, and it's kind of cool. And I think there's a big, I thought about you, Sorkin, there's a big Krispy Kreme thing somewhere down here.
Yeah,
the
I know,
most
a
lights
new one.
Ever. Most lights ever. And I was looking for it, and I was thinking about you. I got to stop thinking about you when I'm not at work, because that's not what I want in my life.
You know, you may draw me back to Times Square, but so may Krispy Kreme. So we'll see.
It's yeah, a good, that's a real inducement.
We were talking about this with Tyler for the last couple weeks. I haven't been in there in a while, and he was saying there is nobody around. He said he was at 30 Rock, you know, middle of the day, and it's just, there's no one on the streets. I mean, is that the case?
There's people here. There's people here.
A few, I guess.
It's not like Times Square. I mean, when you say Times Square, it's supposed to be like, you know, New Year's Eve.
Right.
But compared to where it was, it's like everything. Are people flying on airplanes, Kelly? There are some people, but
more
compared to
were,
where it was,
yeah.
It's definitely down 80%, 90% on the terms of the traffic we have out there. But we do have a beautiful American flag.
Yes.
All the time.
The president said the U.S. could start distributing a COVID vaccine as early as next month.
As soon as it is announced, we'll be able to start. That'll be from mid-October on, maybe a little bit later than that, but we'll be all set. So as soon as it's given the go-ahead, they're doing trials, as you know, and as soon as it's given the go-ahead, we will get it out, defeat the virus.
Now, that, of course, contradicts earlier remarks made yesterday by his CDC director. Those remarks were made to the Senate. Dr. Robert Redfield said he expects vaccinations to begin in November or December, but in limited quantities.
I think we have to assume that if we had a vaccine, say, released today, that it's going to take us probably in the order of 9 months, 6 to 9 months to get the American public vaccinated.
Saw a lot of that news conference. It is a little bit surreal. You know, I don't know. We'll see what happens. And it is being politicized by both sides. One side wants it before the election. The other side doesn't want it until after the election, which is sick enough. But watching the president explain how these you know, some of the people at the CDC and others explained that, yeah, I think, I just don't think they understood the question. I think he was confused. I think, you know, it's a hard case to sell. We're getting sort of inured to it, but I don't know when it's going to be. You know, I think we're going to be talking about the vaccine more today and the prospects for it.
And I was curious, Joe, I don't know if you guys have already talked about this, but your own feelings about getting it. I mean, are you pro? Are you nervous?
I'm totally ready. I think I'd be first in line. I'm ready right now. I'm ready for my immune system. You know, I know that there could be some potential side effects, but I think I can. I'd certainly much rather have a little spike protein fragment than the virus itself. I'd like to get, you know, I'd like my immune system. I had an antibody test a month or two ago. And after someone in my family months ago didn't know she had it at all, but had antibodies to it. So I thought, I wonder if, you know, that would be like winning a lottery, right? If you took the test and you had it.
No symptoms, yeah.
But, you know, I have fantasies that maybe, you know, when I had a little, it didn't feel exactly right for a couple of days. I'm hoping I was one of those asymptomatic people, but I have no reason to think I did ever. But, wouldn't you get that test before you got the vaccine? I think you'd do that too.
That's a good point.
The vaccine. Wouldn't you get it an antigen test first, antibody test first?
Yeah. Andrew, what are your feelings on it?
Would you get it, Andrew?
I probably likely to take something. I want to see which one is approved first. I want to understand it. I think, like so many other people, I think I just want to understand the dynamics of how it works, what the possible ramifications may be.
Right.
Talk to the various doctors
that
we all get the opportunity to talk to. So
this is a guy who gets one of those iPhone upgrades and no. You wait a couple of weeks for the iPhone software upgrade, don't you, Andrew?
Yes.
Before the bugs
I wait a
come
couple
out,
of so. Weeks for the upgrade on the software, so I'll probably wait a couple right. weeks on this.
There you
and
go.
I'll proudly wear my mask between now and then. So
yeah. All right. We're now 2 weeks away from a key deadline for airlines and others, but think of this. The federal aid linked prohibition on job cuts. So you're not allowed to do that. It expires after September 30th, though, meaning we could see mass layoffs on October 1st. Airlines and labor unions are renewing calls for lawmakers to approve another $25 billion in payroll support. They said airlines could furlough or lay off more than 30,000 people when the current term expires. And that another round of relief could protect jobs through the end of March. And they like to mess with me in the control room, Sorkin. They gave me this airline read. I don't want to get you started on this. I mean, it'd be another $25 billion. It's possible some shareholders benefit of these airlines and aren't completely wiped out by the pandemic in trying to actually keep some of the jobs there. I mean, I don't want to, you know, we probably should go, Brad. I didn't want to get you off on one of those rants
if you're trying to bait me, you know my view. If you want to support crony capitalism, go with God, but I'm not going to do it.
Every person that you've asked about that says that the airlines are essential and this was not their fault and it was something
It doesn't matter whether the airlines are essential.
But you'll never get
it has
able
nothing to,
raise to
do
money
with being
again.
Essential.
If everybody gets sacrificed,
If there's a private market, let the private market
do
it, and the shareholders should benefit.
What about this $25 billion?
If the taxpayer is going to pay for it, there should be some benefit to the tax, a genuine benefit to the taxpayer, and the shareholder on the other end shouldn't pay for it.
But we're trying to
save jobs
here. The thing
is that employees and these CEOs wanted to tell the truth, they would, and they actually thought that they were really under that much pressure, they'd stand up and say, yes, give me the money. We desperately need the money, and we're willing to give the shareholders something back. But they're not
planning
to do that.
How come you said
you know? And that's crony capitalism. Everything you say, you hate.
You started this with, you know how I feel, so I'm not going to be baited into this. And then, did you see that, Kelly? People are actually messaging me saying, oh, my God, you just hook, line, and sinker. Couldn't wait to take that bait. Maybe we'll talk more. I don't know. It's better when you argue with guests than when you argue with me.
A good thing, Andrew. It's a good thing. You got to stand up for what you believe in.
Yes.
I love
it. He does.
Somebody's got to.
But for some reason, you hate airlines. Even though you hate driving on long trips and you love, you know, the front of the plane, you still seem
love
to
airlines.
Hate airline. You still... That's the only crony capitalism you ever bring up.
It's about fairness. It's about fairness for the shareholder and fairness. It's about fairness for the shareholder and fairness for the taxpayer.
But we're bailing everyone out.
Taxpayer.
Why pick on
the
airline?
It's your money, Joe.
No, I know.
It's your
money.
You're subsidizing the shareholders.
I just drove 13 hours.
You like subsidizing
the
shareholders?
I drove down 13 hours and back 13 hours.
You want to subsidize the shareholders?
Because I want, eventually I want other people to continue to own the airline stocks and fund the industry and keep it viable. Keep all the jobs, keep all the flight attendants, all the pilots.
Okay.
Keep all the, like the roots. I like the convenience.
I didn't know that you had become a socialist, but God bless you.
I've been working with you for 11 years. How could I not?
He's been listening.
Yeah, I've been with you for 11 years. You don't think some of my stuff's rubbing off on you?
This whole corporate cronyism, socialism effort, I didn't know the roles were reversed.
Coming up on Squawk Pod, the ticking clock for a COVID vaccine. We'll hear from Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel on the pressure.
The only piece for me that is important is the safety of a process and the integrity of drug development.
And when they'll have enough research data to know if they have a vaccine that works.
Our base plan is November. Mm. And that's what we have been saying for many months. Our best possible outcome will be October.
This is Squawk Pod from CNBC. Moderna Therapeutics vaccine candidate with the really exciting name of mRNA-1273 is nearing the finish line in its push to enroll 30,000 individuals in a late-stage trial of a novel coronavirus vaccine. But the company may be able to grab an early win if it's able to show that people who got the vaccine in its trial fared better than those who didn't, who got the placebo. Moderna is just one of the three drug makers backed by the U.S. in late-stage testing for a vaccine. The other two are Pfizer and AstraZeneca. Meanwhile, infectious disease experts and scientists have said they have concerns that the White House may be pressuring the FDA to approve a vaccine before it has been adequately tested. Last week, 9 companies, including Moderna, released a letter pledging that they would prioritize safety and uphold the integrity of the scientific process in their efforts to develop coronavirus vaccines. Here's Joe Kernan.
Moderna holding its R&D day, the company announcing that 25,296 participants have now enrolled in the phase 3 of its coronavirus vaccine trial, and that is near the number that's enrolled in the Pfizer trial. Meg Terrell joins us now with a special guest, and thank you for that, Meg. I 29,000 wasn't going to be enough. I needed that 296 just to, I mean, are you sure, what if it's maybe 297 now, right? I mean, probably exactly right.
Somebody could have received a vaccine this morning. You never know, Joe.
Yeah,
so that special guest joining us, of course, is Moderna's CEO, Stéphane Bancel. Stéphane, thanks for being with us. You know, Joe pointed out that number. There's another really important number you put out this morning as well, which is the number of people in this trial who've received the second dose of the vaccine, more than 10,000. So judging by how quickly this trial has enrolled and how quickly people are getting that second shot, what does that tell you about when we might get to see the data?
Well, good morning, Megan. Thank you for having us back. So we're sticking to what we have said before, which is based on the current epidemiology, the rate of infection in the country at the location and counties where we have sites. We anticipate our base plan for efficacy for the first interim readout to be in November. That's our base plan. Our best plan is October. I think it's unlikely, but it's possible. And if the infection rate in the country was to slow down in the next weeks, it could potentially be pushed out as a worst-case scenario, I would say, in December.
I see. And you've also published this morning, you announced in your press release, the protocols for the clinical trial. Now, this is something that the scientific community has started to push for. It's not something the drug industry typically shares in clinical trials. And in fact, other companies have declined to make this information public. Why did you decide to share all of these plans about the statistical analyses for the trial?
Because of transparency. You know, we believe this is unprecedented times. There's a lot of suffering from a public health standpoint, from an economic standpoint. And there's a lot of questions. As you know, usually only people like you and I, you know, care about clinical trial design and stuff like that. But it's a very unusual time. And, you know, we as an industry have been working really hard for 9 months now chasing this virus. And if the Moderna vaccine were to get a good safety readout and a good efficacy readout and be approved by the agency, we care deeply that this vaccine is trusted by the public, by clinicians and nurses around the country, so it is used. It would be, of course, a big waste if we work so hard to get a vaccine to work and people don't trust the safety, number one, and the efficacy of the vaccine. And so we thought, like, you know, we signed the pledge with the rest of the industry last week, saying we'll adhere to the highest standard of ethics as we conduct that study. And so we thought that sharing the protocol publicly, which is online right now, will allow anybody to look at it, and we can have an understanding of all the governance and the safety that is in place to ensure the safety of the participants and the integrity of the scientific and medical process.
Yeah, and on that point of safety, of course, we saw AstraZeneca's trials halted last week after a safety issue in one participant in the UK. They since got the green light to restart the trials in the UK, not yet here in the United States, and they are not sharing information about what the diagnosis was or how they knew it was safe to resume. So I'm wondering your thoughts. First, have you seen any safety signals that might be similar to what we heard about that, potentially a spinal cord issue we heard from the NIH director? Has that trial forced you or regulators to take any kind of closer look? And do you think that we need more transparency about the communications around that particular safety issue so people feel more comfortable with it?
Yeah, so I think the first point is that it shows that the process is working. The fact that the safety committee, which is independent from AstraZeneca, decided to pause the study in all the sites around the world, I think is a good news. It shows, and this is, happens regularly in vaccine clinical development, that when something doesn't look right, the safety committee acts quickly. It's very difficult for me to know to comment on communications or details because I'm not part of a company, of course, and I have no insight of any of the data. The only piece for me that is important is the safety of a process and the integrity of drug development. As to the question about the FDA, again, I'm not able to make any comment given I have not talked to the FDA about that topic, of course. Only discussion with the FDA is, of course, around the Moderna trial. But what I know is that our safety committee, which is an independent committee, independent from the company that reviews on a very regular basis the data, I trust their judgment. Those are clinicians that are expert in clinical trial development for vaccines. And I'm sure that if they see anything that is worrying to them, they will put the trial on hold.
Mr. Bansal, could you just go back to some of your earlier comments and clarify them? When you said your base plan is October, but then I think you said it was unlikely but possible. Could you explain that? And then also, why a slower infection rate in the country this fall would actually delay the arrival of that vaccine until maybe December?
Yes, so let me clarify. Our base plan, our most probable plan is November. And that's what we have been saying for many months. Our best possible outcome will be October. And the reason it depends on infection rate in the country is we are all running in the industry, as per FDA guidelines, efficacy trials. We're not looking at antibody levels in people's blood to decide if a vaccine works or may not work. It's looking at efficacy. So for efficacy, given it's 50% placebo, meaning half of the people get a placebo and half got the real vaccine, we are basically counting the cases of disease. This is how the trial is designed. And so it's sad to say, but that's how clinical research goes. We need people getting disease from the virus to be able to scientifically, in a very rigorous process, calculate how many people get the disease with a vaccine, how many people get the disease on placebo, to calculate the efficacy. And the FDA has said they want at least a 50% efficacy in the vaccines to consider the application for approval.
I had similar questions, Stefan, because you have seen in the past there will be a placebo and a group getting a medicine, and sometimes the people getting the medicine show so much progress that it's no longer ethical to not allow the placebo the same treatment. Is that possible that could happen in this case, or did the concerns you just outlined make it unlikely that you would know that quickly? And I'm talking about, you know, when you're offsetting safety against efficacy, I don't know if there's enough efficacy to override what you need to do with safety. Is it possible this could be ended early or not?
That's a great question, Joe, and it is technically possible. As you say, we do not know the efficacy of our vaccine. That is why we're doing a phase 3 study to know that. But indeed, if a vaccine were to have a very high efficacy, it is possible sometime in the process that the safety committee, which sees all the data and all the cases, will determine that it is not ethical to keep going with people getting placebo. They might determine that it is not ethical maybe for the elderly and not for the younger adults. So it's a very complex, you know, answers to provide because it so much depends on the scientific data. But it is a possibility that, of course, our safety committee is ready to recommend if they deem in their medical judgment it's the right thing to do for the participants.
Stefan, it's Meg again. You know, I need to ask you about an issue that people are focused on, executive stock sales at Moderna. And I understand that in your most recent quarterly filing, you noted that to try to avoid any distraction as you're pursuing this mission for a COVID-19 vaccine, everybody has agreed not to enter into new 10b5-1 trading plans, add new shares to these plans, or engage in additional unscheduled sales of Moderna stock in the open market. Tell us why you made that decision. And also, you know, as these criticisms mount, do people really make a differentiation between these scheduled sales and ones that were already part of these plans? I understand, you know, as recently as a few days ago, you and others on the executive team have had these scheduled stock sales. So people keep seeing these mount up. Why not just stop them completely?
Yeah, so there's a lot of considerations to be taken in stopping the plan. As you know, this is highly regulated by the SEC. What we've decided to do with the team and the board in terms of not starting new plan is because the phase three is ongoing, even though we have access to no data, because again, the safety committee, which is independent from the company, has access to the data. I don't even know if we have had cases so far, Meg, and how many we have. I have seen nothing since we started dosing subjects, as it should be. But just to make sure that there is no suspicion of wrongdoing, which again will be impossible given I have access to no data, we just thought it was better just to put that in place. And so that's what we communicated in our SEC filings.
All right, Stefan Bancel, we'll be staying tuned for base case November, best case October, and we'll be watching your R&D day today where I know you'll be going through the entire pipeline. So thanks for being with us this morning.
Thanks for calling me.
Next on Squawk Pod, a blizzard on Wall Street. Cloud company Snowflake made history with the largest software IPO ever, an evaluation on par with Goldman Sachs. Venture capitalist Peter Wagner got in on the ground floor.
The enterprise is transforming, and it's transforming at all layers. Snowflake is certainly a great example of a company that benefits from that.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Squawk Pod.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Joe Kernan and Kelly Evans in today with us. Becky is off today.
You're going to talk about this Snowflake thing, God almighty. Anyway, can either of you give me a 30-second synopsis of Hadoop and how this is better than Hadoop?
No.
Did you, Andrew, on Google, there's a 10-hour, very quick course on Hadoop, and I'm thinking about doing it. Maybe not. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, this was Hadoop was supposedly.
I want to know who at Berkshire took the course, Joe. That's what I want to know.
On Hadoop. This does not Hadoop. I think this somehow leapfrogs Hadoop's technology. It's you know.
We're in the stack. Yeah.
That's right. The biggest software IPO ever. The biggest IPO of the year and the biggest first day jump for an IPO that raised more than $1 billion in two decades. Snowflake made history in many ways yesterday. It's a data management cloud-based company. And until this week, for many on Wall Street, Snowflake conjured only images of winter, or in Joe Kernan's case, millennials. It's safe to say that's no longer the case. Snowflake raised $3.4 billion by pricing shares more than 40% above the range it had initially been marketing. By the end of the day, yesterday, Snowflake shares soared 112%, giving that company a $71 billion valuation. For comparison, Snowflake started the day the size of Constellation Brands and ended it with a valuation on par with Goldman Sachs. Early investors made billions, at least on paper. For early, long-time investors, that's as much as $11 billion. Later buy-ins, like Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, now sitting on a cool $1.6 billion, double the original investment. Berkshire's involvement in an IPO at all, let alone one in a cloud company that few had heard of, is significant. The last time Warren Buffett invested in a newly public company, the year was 1956, and the company was Ford.
Shut up, be standing on the corner, watching all the boys, be the guy who's going.
Now, as striking as this debut was, Snowflake is still unprofitable. It's spending more in sales and marketing than it's making. But those who bought into it pre- and post-IPO don't seem to mind. After the listing, CEO Frank Slootman had one thing on his mind.
We are primarily focused on growth, but what we're not focused on is what people refer to as growth at all costs.
And his investors seem to trust him. The earliest ones were betting on the data biz long before anyone else believed this kind of cloud enterprise was worthwhile. It seems like the rest of the market has caught on by now. The Nasdaq's Emerging Cloud Index, which consists of over 50 public companies, is up 55% this year. That's compared to only 25% gain for the Nasdaq and a 5.3% gain for the S&P. Let's get back to Kelly.
Let's talk a little bit more about this now with an analyst, Doug Clinton, managing partner at Loop Ventures. Doug, can you kind of start by telling people why Snowflake is such a valuable asset in general here?
I think over the last decade, we've heard so much about this trend toward big data. And the next evolution, in our opinion, of big data is really big data management, because the point of big data is to create intelligent software. It's to create incredible experiences for users. And it's really the precursor to AI. And what Snowflake does, I think why people are really excited about it thematically, is it is sort of that bridge, in our opinion, from big data to more intelligent software. They help companies essentially architect their data more intelligently in the cloud.
So we were joking about Hadoop a second ago, but I mean, who are the rivals in this space? How much of a lead does Snowflake have? How much of a moat does it have, to use the Berkshire language?
So I think really, when I think about their competition, some of their biggest competition are actually the companies they work with, the cloud providers themselves, AWS, Google, Microsoft with Azure. Those are the ones that I would be most focused on. Certainly there's other ones in the market like Hadoop. There's other companies that are sort of, I'd say, in the same game, in the same league, companies like Databricks, which is a private company still. But I do think that if I were an investor in Snowflake, I would be focused more on those big cloud providers trying to expand their capabilities, right, and sort of shutting Snowflake out of the market.
As we know, Amazon loves to go down the balance sheet and turn every cost center into a new revenue item. So Snowflake would appear to be a candidate for that. What's its valuation right now, Doug? At about $245 this morning, right about its IPO price. What are we talking about in terms of the multiple on revenue, and does it generate earnings?
It doesn't generate earnings yet. I think in our rough estimate, it's somewhere around 70 times next year's revenue. That would make it, even at the time of the IPO, I think it was one of the most expensive software companies in the market. And now I think it is far and away one of the most expensive companies in the software market.
Doug, I read a quote that someone said that the pandemic accelerated this cloud adoption or the cloud migration by 10 years. And I, you know, we're hearing everything. The pandemic, you know, stay at home. It's accelerated everything. Is that true? And why? Do you agree with that?
10 years feels aggressive to me. I would believe it if it was maybe a year or two. I think we've certainly seen this acceleration in terms of productivity software, software to help people work at home. Much of that software is managed in the cloud. But when I think about the bigger opportunity in the cloud, it's moving everything, even things beyond this sort of work at home trend, into the cloud. So I think it's maybe more like a year or two it's been accelerated. That doesn't mean that the trend isn't real. I think it's still a real long-term trend. Cloud computing is here to stay, but I don't think it's been accelerated that quickly.
Doug, when people talk to you about, okay, it's a 70 times revenue name, but to use an imperfect analogy, but the last IPO that Berkshire bought into was Ford in 1955, I think. I mean, does this have the kind of potential for the next several decades that a Ford would have had back then?
As crazy as it might sound, I think it does. When we think about this trend toward AI and the amount of data that will go into creating intelligent software applications, I think you could see the necessity for software solutions like Snowflake increase by 10x over the next 10 years.
Fascinating. Doug, thanks so much, sir. We appreciate it. Doug Clinton with Loop Ventures joining us this morning.
So, guys, I was just thinking about this. I think about Jeff Bezos. So when this was founded like 7-8 years ago or something, and it was founded on the notion, all right, we're going to compete with Amazon AWS. And they said, nobody can compete with AWS. What the hell was, he sold books. online. Why were they, 8 years ago, already the leading behemoth in cloud and AWS?
I think they literally had a guy in like South Africa who was like, do you mind if I use some of your extra server space for a while? They go, yeah, no problem. And the next thing you know, they're like, hey, maybe we should do this for everybody.
That's why he's the richest guy in the world, Sorkin. Yeah. What have you thought? You know, you've thought of a few things, but I wasn't thinking about the cloud and maybe opening up my Commodore to store something. Let's get to someone that was the seed financer of this. Yeah, thanks. It's an early Snowflake investor. Just reading up on this, Peter. Peter Wagner is founding partner of Wing Ventures. Peter led Wing's seed investment in Snowflake. The firm's participated in every round of financing since. So that was back in 2013. I was reading through all this stuff. You're like my idol now, Peter. I guess you're 8 years smarter or 7 years smarter than Berkshire Hathaway to be in here. And this is what you've seeded 25 companies that have come public. And you have a summa cum laude physics degree from Harvard. I guess that's how you figure this stuff out. Maybe you can explain Hadoop to all of us today and how people thought that was going to be the state of the art. And this was an Empire Strikes Back moment for Snowflake.
Yeah, well, there were a number of contrarian ideas around the early Snowflake, and you touched on one of them. Snowflake was really built around unleashing relational technology, which is what enterprise data and analytics had been built on really since the 1970s. And a lot of people thought that wouldn't be possible. Newer frameworks like Hadoop, which you just mentioned, were all the rage. But the Snowflake founders felt that they could harness the power of the cloud in a way that wasn't obvious to really create a new generation of enterprise analytics. And I think history has shown them to be correct.
It was funny because in your notes, it reminded me of a joke like that economists tell you. You talk about a fun joke or a fun interaction between the Snowflake CEO back then and the co-founder of Cloudera, which was a Hadoop company. And I don't get the joke. I guess that's why. But they had this big argument and they were going back and forth. And people in the know thought it was really clever. But it's very arcane to try to understand exactly what's happening. But the bottom line is, you think companies like this grow into the valuation that is manifested early on, and that's the only way you can own them is to bite the bullet, buy with a crazy 100-time revenue valuation, and then wait around for something good to happen, and it does, in your view?
Well, sometimes. It's easy to underestimate the long-term potential of the true platform companies in our industry. And that really is the opportunity that's so exciting about Snowflake is it is our industry's first true data cloud, which is an enormously powerful concept. The modern enterprise is built on data. It's powered by AI. And the data cloud and the cloud data platform are the most strategic layers within the enterprise technology stack that's enabling this transformation of business. That's the potential. And now that it's become visible, there's a lot of people that want to be part of that. I mean, there is another way to own these, which is to work with the founders when they're just starting the company. And that's obviously how we got involved.
One thing I quoted you on earlier was that the pandemic has accelerated a move to the cloud by 5 to 10 years. And someone earlier said maybe 1 or 2 years, but make your case for why you believe that to be true, 5 to 10 years.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the enterprise is transforming, and it's transforming at all layers. The technology that it runs on, the types of applications that it uses, the way that its people work together. And the pandemic accelerated some trends like remote work, which we're dealing with right now during this broadcast. But it accelerated a lot of fundamental trends, too, surrounding the cloud and has really pushed enterprises towards cloud adoption. And Snowflake is certainly a great example of a company that benefits from that. But, this was going on anyway. This is really one of the fundamental trends of our generation. I think it's a 5 to 10 year pull forward just because there really, I think, was already emerging consensus within enterprise IT, as well as new companies being born in the cloud, that this was the only way to go. The pandemic really created a burn the boats moment that forced that shift to happen.
So you're going to stick with this enterprise stuff, I guess. But I was going to tell you, ask if you can call me next time you think something's really going to be big. You know what I'm saying? Like plastics or something from the ground. But it's still going to be enterprise stuff, right? You're going to stick with this?
At Wing, we're all about the enterprise. And, right. and this whole development of the modern enterprise is what the firm was really founded to help founders enable.
Yeah.
So that's what we do.
Well, we'll have you back. Interesting. I'd like to know a lot more, but I said earlier, I saw a Google video on how to understand Hadoop, and it was only 10 hours, the course, and supposedly I'd be really good at it by then. Should I do that? Will I want my 10 hours back, or what do you think?
I think the world has moved on from Hadoop. There's other things to study that I would suggest.
I don't want to hear from Cloudera. All right. Thank you very
not
much.
Not even the cutting edge, Joey. You would spend 10 hours.
I'm finally figuring it out. I'm finally figuring it out, and the world has moved on. You know, that's a story of my life.
Yeah, mine too.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Thanks to Kelly Evans for sitting in today. You can tune in to our TV show weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 a.m. Eastern and subscribe to Squawk Pod. Listen whenever you want, whenever it works for you. That's what's so great about podcasts. Tell a friend to subscribe and tweet us at Squawk CNBC anytime. We'll meet you back here tomorrow.